gesture, angry at being forced to explain what she thought must be obvious. "Surely you've wondered why the Mysteriarchs left the Mid-Realm, left a land where we had everything, power, wealth. Oh, I know what is said of us. I know because we were the ones who said it. We had grown disgusted with the barbaric life, with the constant warring with the elves. The truth is we left because we had to. We had no choice. Our magic was dwindling. Intermarriage with ordinary humans had diluted it. That's why there are so many wizards in this world of yours. Many, but weak. Those of us of pure blood were few but strong. To ensure the continuation of our race, we fled to some place where we could not be contaminated," suggested Hugh. Iridol flushed and bit her lip. Then, raising her head, she faced him with pride. "I know you say that with contempt, but yes, that is true. Can you blame us?" "But it didn't work. The journey was difficult, and many died. More succumbed before the magical dome that protects us against the bitter cold and gives us air to breathe could be stabilized. At last all seemed well, and children were born to us, but not many, and most of those died." Her pride drained from her, her head drooped. "Bane is the only child of his generation left alive, and now the dome is collapsing. That shimmer in the sky that you find so beautiful is, to us, deadly. The buildings are an illusion. The people pretend to be a large population so that you won't guess the truth."
"You have to return to the world below, but you're afraid to go back and reveal how weak you've grown," finished Hugh. "The changeling became the Prince of Volcarim, and now he's going back as king."
"King? That's impossible. They already have a king."
"Not impossible, madam. Your husband's planning to hire me to get rid of their king and queen, and then Bane, their son, will inherit the throne."
"I don't believe you. You're lying."
"Yes, you believe me. I see it in your face. It's not your husband you're defending, it's yourself. You know what your husband's capable of doing. You know what he's done, and what you haven't. Maybe it wasn't murder, but he would have caused two people down there in the Mid-Realm less pain if he'd driven knives into them instead of taking their baby."
The dark, colorless eyes tried to meet his, but they faltered and fell. "I grieved for them. I tried to save their child. I would have given my life if their baby could have lived. And then there are the lives of so many others.
I've done evil, but it seems to me, Iridol, that there is equal evil in not doing. Sinistrat is returning to conclude his deal with me. Listen to what he has planned and judge for yourself."
Iridol stared at him, started to speak. Then, shaking her head, she shut her eyes, and, in an instant, was gone. Her chains were too heavy. She couldn't break free. Hugh sank back down, alone in his cell within a cell. Pulling out his pipe, he clamped it between his teeth and glared at the prison walls. Walk the Dragon Wing. If Sinistrad intended to startle him by his sudden appearance, the Mysteriarch must have been disappointed. Hugh glanced up at him, but neither moved nor spoke.
"Well, Hugh the Hand, have you decided?" "It wasn't much of a decision."
Rising stiffly to his feet, Hugh carefully wrapped the pipe in its cloth and tucked it away near his breast.
"I don't want to spend the rest of my life in this place. I'll work for you. I've worked for worse. After all, I once took money to kill a child."
Chapter 54. Castle Sinister, High Realm. Haplo wandered the corridors of the castle, idly wasting time, or so it seemed, when anyone paid any attention to him. When no one was around, he continued searching, keeping account of everyone as best he could. The dog was with Bane. Haplo had overheard every word of the conversation between father and son. The patron had been caught off guard by Bane's strange question about the sigil. Scratching the skin beneath his bandages, Haplo wondered if the child could have seen the runes. The patron tried to think back to a time when he might have slipped up, made a mistake. Finally, he decided he hadn't. It would have been impossible. What, then, was the boy talking about? Surely not some mensch wizard trying his hand at runes. Even a mensch had more sense. Well, there's no use wasting brain power speculating. I'll find out soon enough. Bane, dog faithfully trotting along at the boy's side, had recently passed him in the hallway, searching for Alfred. Perhaps that conversation will give me a clue. Meanwhile, there's Limbeck to check up on. Pausing before the door of the Geg's room, Haplo glanced up and down the hall. No one was in sight. He traced a sigil upon the door and the wood disappeared, at least to his eyes. To the Geg, sitting disconsolately at a desk, the door seemed as solid as ever. Limbeck had asked his host for writing materials and seemed to be absorbed in his favorite pastime, speech composing. But Haplo saw that very little composing was being accomplished. Spectacles pushed up on his forehead, the Geg sat, head in hand, staring into a tapestry-covered stone wall that for him was a multicolored blur.
"My fellow workers united..." "Oh, that's too restricting. My fellow Wups and Giggs. But the High Froman might be there. High Froman, head clerk, fellow Wups, brother Giggs, brother and sister Giggs. I have seen the world above, and it is beautiful. Limbeck's voice softened. More beautiful and wondrous than anything you can imagine. And I... No. He tugged violently on his own beard. There, he said, wincing at the pain and blinking the tears from his eyes. As Jara would say, I'm a droogle. Now maybe I can think better. My dear Wups. No, there I go again. I've leapt out the High Froman. Haplow removed the sigil, and the door took shape and form again. He could hear, as he continued down the corridor, Limbeck reciting to his crowd of one. The Geg knows what he has to say, thought Haplow. He just can't bring himself to say it. Oh, Alfred, here you are. It was Bane's voice coming to Haplow through the dog. I've been searching all over for you. The child sounded petulant, put out. I'm sorry, Your Highness. I was looking for Sir Hugh. He wasn't the only one. Stopping at the next door, Haplow glanced inside. The room was empty. Hugh was gone. Haplow was not particularly surprised. If Hugh was even still alive, it was only because Sinistra had intended to make him suffer. Or, better yet, use him to make Iridol suffer. This jealousy Sinistrad was exhibiting over his wife was strange, considering he obviously didn't care for her. She's his possession, said Haplow to himself, turning back down the hallway and heading for Limbeck's room. If Hugh'd been discovered making off with the spoons, Sinistrad would probably have been just as mad. Well, I tried to protect him. Pity, he was a bold fellow. I could have used him. Now, however, while Sinistrad is preoccupied with Hugh, would be an excellent time for the rest of us to leave. Alfred, Bane was speaking in sugared tones. I want to have a talk with you. Certainly, Your Highness. The dog settled itself on the floor between them. Time to leave, Haplow repeated. I'll collect Limbeck, we'll get back to the elf ship and take it, and leave this mensch wizard stranded on his realm. I don't have to put up with his meddling. I'll transport the gig back to Drevlin. Once that's done, I will have accomplished my lord's goals. Except for bringing him back someone from this world to train as a disciple. I'd considered Hugh, but he's out, apparently. Still, my lord should be satisfied. This world is wobbling about on the brink of disaster. If all goes well, I can nudge it over the edge. And I believe that I can safely say that there are no longer any Sartan. Alfred, said Bane, I know you're a Sartan. Haplow came to a dead stop. It must be a mistake. He hadn't heard right. He'd been thinking the word, and therefore heard it, when in reality the boy had said something else. Holding his breath, almost wishing impatiently he could still the pounding of his heart so that he could hear more clearly, Haplow listened. Alfred felt the world slide out beneath his feet. Walls expanded, the ceiling seemed to be falling down on top of him, and he thought for an awful blessed moment that he might faint. But this time his brain refused to shut down. This time he would have to face the peril and deal with it as best he could. He knew he should be saying something, denying the boy's statement, of course, but he honestly didn't know whether or not he could talk. His face muscles were paralyzed. Come, Alfred, said Bane, regarding him with smug self-assurance. There's no use denying it. I know it's true. Do you want to know how I know? The child was enjoying this immensely. And there was the dog, its head raised, watching him intently, as if it understood every word, and it, too, was awaiting his reaction. The dog. Of course it was understanding every word, and so was its master. You remember the time when the tree fell on me? Bane was saying. I was dead. I knew I was dead because I was floating away, and I looked back and saw my body lying on the ground with the crystal pieces sticking right through me. But suddenly it was like a great big mouth opened and sucked me back, and I woke up and there weren't any crystals hurting me anymore. I looked down, and there on my chest I saw this. Bane held up the piece of paper he had removed from his father's desk. I asked my father about it. He said it was a sigil, a rune of healing. Deny it. Laugh lightly. What an imagination you have, Your Highness. You dreamed it, of course, that bump on your head. And then there was Hugh, Bane continued. I know that I gave him enough Hefbane to kill him. When he fell over all in a heap, he was dead, just like me. You brought him back to life. Come now, Your Highness, if I was a Sartan, what would I be doing earning my living as a servant? No, I'd live in a grand palace, and you mensch would all flock to see me and fall at my feet and beg me to give you this and give you that and raise you up and cast your enemies down and offer me whatever I wanted except peace. And now that I know you're a Sartan, Alfred, you've got to help me. And the first thing we're going to do is kill my father. Bane reached into his tunic, pulled out a dagger that Alfred recognized as belonging to Hugh. Look, I found this in my father's desk. Sinistrad's going to go down to the Low Realm and send the Geggs to war and fix the Kixie-Winsie and make it align all the isles, and then he'll control the water supply. All the wealth and power will go to him, and that's not fair. It was my idea. I was the one who figured out how the machine worked. And of course, Alfred, you probably know all about running the machine since you and your people built it, and you can help me with that, too. The dog, with its far too intelligent eyes, was looking at Alfred, looking straight through him. Too late to deny. He'd missed his chance. He'd never been quick-thinking, quick-reacting. That was why his brain had taken to shutting down when confronted with danger. It couldn't cope with the constant war that raged inside him. The instinctive urge to use his wondrous powers to protect himself and others versus the terrible knowledge that if he did so, he would be exposed for the demigod he was and wasn't.
I cannot help you, Your Highness. I cannot take a life.
Oh, but you'll have to. You won't have any choice. If you don't, I'll tell my father who you are. And once my father finds out, he'll try to use you himself.
And, Your Highness, I will refuse.
You can't. He'll try to kill you if you don't obey him. Then you'll have to fight, and you'll win because you're stronger.
No, Your Highness, I will lose. I will die.
Bane was startled, perplexed. Obviously, this was one move that had never occurred to him.
But you can't. You're a certain.
We are not immortal. Something I think we forgot.
It was the despair that had killed them. The despair he was feeling now, a great and overwhelming sadness. They had dared to think and act as gods and had ceased to listen to the true gods. Things had begun to go wrong, as the Sartan saw it. And they had taken it upon themselves to decide what was best for the world and act accordingly. But then something else went wrong and they had to step in and fix it. And every time they fixed one thing, it caused something else to break. And soon the task became too large. There were too few of them. And they had realized finally that they had tampered with what should have been left undisturbed. But by then it was too late.
I will die, repeated Alfred.
The dog rose to its feet, came over to him, and laid its head on his knee. Slowly, hesitantly, he reached out his hand to touch it and felt its warmth, the well-shaped bones of the head hard beneath the silky fur. And what is your master doing now? What is Haplo thinking, knowing that his ancient enemy is within his grasp? I can't begin to guess. It all depends, I suppose, on what Haplo was doing in this world in the first place. The Chamberlain smiled, much to Bane's frustration and ire. Alfred was wondering what Sinistrad would do if he knew he had two demigods under his roof.
You might be ready to die, Alfred, said Bane with sudden sly cunning. But what about our friends, the Geg and Hugh and Haplo?
At the sound of its master's name, the dog's plumy tail brushed slowly from side to side. Bane came forward to stand at the Chamberlain's side, the child's small hands clasped earnestly on his servant's shoulder.
When I tell Father who you are, and when I prove to him how I know who you are, he'll realize, like I do now, that we won't need any of these others. We won't need the elves or their ship, because your magic can take us where we want to go. We won't need Limbeck, because you can talk to the Geggs and convince them to go to war. We don't need Haplo. We never did need Haplo. I'll take care of his dog. We don't need Hugh. Father won't kill you, Alfred. He'll control you by threatening to kill them, so you can't die.
What he says is true. And Sinistrad would certainly realize it. Expendable. I make them all expendable. But what can I do to save them except kill?
The truly wonderful part, said Bane, giggling, is that at the end of it all, we won't even need Father.
It is the old curse of the Sartan coming back to me at last. If I had allowed the child to die, as perhaps he was meant to, then none of this would have happened. But I had to meddle. I had to play God. I believed that there was good in the child, that he would change because of me. I believed that I could save him. I. All we Sartan ever thought about was ourselves. We wanted to mold the world in our image, but perhaps that wasn't what was intended. Slowly, gently thrusting aside the dog, Alfred rose to his feet. Walking to the center of the room, he lifted his arms into the air and began to move in a solemn and strangely graceful, for his ungainly body, dance.
Alfred, what the hell are you doing?
I am leaving, Your Highness, said Alfred.
The air around him began to shimmer as his dancing continued. He was tracing the runes in the air with his hands and drawing them on the floor with his feet. Bane's mouth gaped open.
You can't,
he gasped. Running forward, he tried to grab hold of the Sartan, but the magical wall Alfred had built around himself was now too powerful. There was a crackle when Bane's hand touched it, and the child, wailing, snatched back burned fingers.
You can't leave me. No one can leave me unless I want them to.
Your enchantment doesn't work on me, Bane.
Alfred spoke almost sadly, his body beginning to fade away.
It never did.
A large, furry shape plummeted past Bane. The dog bounded through the shimmering shell and landed lightly at Alfred's side. Leaping, teeth snapping, the dog caught the Chamberlain's ankle in its mouth and held on tightly. A startled expression crossed Alfred's now ghost-like face. Frantically, he kicked his leg, trying to jerk it from the dog's mouth. The dog, grinning, seemed to consider this a great game. It held on more tightly and began to growl playfully and tug back. Alfred pulled harder. His body had ceased to fade and was now gradually starting to regain its solidity. Going round and round in a circle, the Chamberlain begged and pleaded, threatened and scolded the dog to let go. The dog followed him around and around, feet skidding as it sought to get a grip on the stone floor with its claws, its jaws clamped firmly around Alfred's leg. The door to the room slammed open. The dog, looking over, wagged its tail furiously, but continued to keep its grip on Alfred.
"So you're leaving us behind, are you, Sarton?" inquired Haplow. "Just like the old days, huh?"
Chapter 55. Castle Sinister, High Realm. In a room down the corridor, Limbeck finally put his pen to paper.
"My people," he began.
Haplow had long imagined meeting a Sartan, meeting someone who had sealed his people in that hellish place. He imagined himself angry, but now even he could not believe his fury. He stared at this man, this Alfred, this Sartan, and he saw the Caedan attacking him. He saw the dog's body lying broken, bleeding. He saw his parents dead. It was suddenly hard to breathe. He was suffocating. Veins, red against fiery yellow, webbed his vision, and he had to close his eyes and fight to catch his breath.
"Leaving again," he gasped for air. "Just like you jailers left us to die in that prison."
Haplow forced the last word out between gritted teeth. Bandaged hands raised like striking talons, he stood quite close to Alfred and stared into the face of the Sartan that seemed surrounded by a halo of flame. If this Alfred smiled, if his lips so much as twitched, Haplow would kill him. His lord, his purpose, his instructions, he couldn't hear any of them for the pounding waves of rage in his head. But Alfred didn't smile. He didn't blench in fright or draw back or even move to defend himself. The lines of the aged, careworn face deepened. The mild eyes were shadowed and red-rimmed, shimmering with sorrow.
"The jailer didn't leave," he said. "The jailer died."
Haplow felt the dog's head press against his knee, and reaching down, he caught hold of the soft fur and gripped it tightly. The dog gazed up with worried eyes and pressed closer, whimpering. Haplow's breathing came easier. Clear sight returned to his eyes, clear thought to his mind.
"I'm all right," said Haplow, drawing a shivering breath. "I'm all right." "Does this mean," asked Bane, "that Alfred's not leaving?"
"No, he's not leaving," said Haplow. "Not now, at least. Not until I'm ready."
Master of himself once more, the patron faced the Sartan. Haplow's face was calm, his smile quiet. His hands rubbed slowly, one against the other, displacing slightly the bandages that covered the skin.
"The jailer died? I don't believe that."
Alfred hesitated, licked his lips.
"Your people have been trapped in that place all this time?"
"Yes, but you knew that already, didn't you? That was your intent."
Limbeck, hearing nothing of what was happening two doors down from him, continued writing.
"My people, I have been in the realms above. I have visited the realms our legends tell us are heaven. And they are. And they aren't. They are beautiful. They are rich, rich beyond belief. The sun shines on them throughout the day. The firmament sparkles in their sky. The rain falls gently without malice. The shadows of the lords of night soothe them to sleep. They live in houses, not in cast-off parts of a machine or in a building the Kixie-Winsy decided it didn't need at the moment. They have winged ships that fly through the air. They have tamed winged beasts to take them anywhere they want, and all of this they have because of us. They lied to us. They told us that they were gods and that we had to work for them. They promised us that if we worked hard, they would judge us worthy and take us up to live in heaven, but they never intended to make good that promise."
"That was never our intent," Alfred answered. "You must believe that, and you must believe that we didn't know you were still there. It was only supposed to be a short time, a few years, several generations."
"A thousand years, 100 generations, those that survived. And where were you? What happened?"
"We had our own problems."
Alfred's gaze lowered, his head bowed.
"You have my deepest sympathy."
Alfred glanced up swiftly, saw the patron's curled lip, and sighing, looked away. "You're coming with me," said Haplow. "I'm going to take you back to see for yourself the hell your people created. And my lord will have questions for you. He'll find it hard to believe, as I do, that the jailer died."
"Your lord?"
"A great man. The most powerful of our kind who has ever lived.
He has plans, many plans, which I'm certain he'll share with you."
And that's why you're here, Alfred murmured. His plans.
No, I won't go with you, the sergeant shook his head. Not voluntarily. Deep within the mild eyes, a spark kindled.
Then I'll use force. I'll enjoy that. I've no doubt, but if you're trying to conceal your presence in this world, his gaze fixed on the bandaged hands, then you know that a fight between us, a duel of that magnitude and magical ferocity, could not be hidden and would be disastrous to you. The wizards in this world are powerful and intelligent. Legends exist about Deathgate. Many, like Sinistrad or even this child, Alfred's hand stroked Bane's hair, could figure out what had occurred and would eagerly start a search for the entry into what is held to be a wondrous world. Is your lord prepared for that?
Lord? What lord? Look here, Alfred, Bane burst out impatiently. None of us are going anywhere as long as my father's alive.
Neither of the two men answered him or even looked at him. The boy glared at them. Adults absorbed in their own concerns, they had, as usual, forgotten his.
At last our eyes have been opened. At last we can see the truth.
Limbeck found his spectacles irritating and pushed them back up on top of his head.
And the truth is that we no longer need them.
I don't need you, Bane cried. You weren't going to help me anyway. I'll do it myself.
Reaching into his tunic, he drew out Hugh's dagger and gazed at it admiringly, running his finger carefully over the rune-carved blade.
Come on, he said to the dog, still standing beside Aplo. You come with me.
The dog looked at the boy and wagged his tail, but did not move.
Come on, Bane coaxed. Good dog.
The dog cocked his head, then turned to Haplo, whining and pawing. The patron, intent on the sartan, shoved the dog aside. Sighing, with a final pleading glance back at its master, the dog, head down, ears flat, padded slowly over to Bane's side. The child shoved the dagger in his belt and patted the dog's head.
That's a good boy. Let's go.
And so, in conclusion,
Limbeck paused. His hand trembled, his eyes misted over. A blot of ink fell upon the paper. Pulling his spectacles down from on top of his head, he adjusted them on his nose, and then sat unmoving, staring at the blank spot where the final words would be written.
Can you truly afford to fight me? Alfred persisted.
I don't think you'll fight, answered Haplo. I think you're too weak, too tired. That kid you pamper is more reminded. Alfred glanced around.
Bane? Where is he?
Haplo made an impatient gesture. Gone somewhere. Don't try to...
I'm not trying anything. You heard what he asked me. He has a knife. He's gone to murder his father. I've got to stop.
No, you don't. Haplo caught hold of the sartan's arm. Let the mensch murder each other. It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter to you at all?
Alfred gave the patron a peculiar, searching look.
No, of course not.
The only one I care about is the leader of the Geggs revolt, and Limbeck's safely shut up in his room.
Then where's your dog? Asked Alfred.
My people,
Limbeck's pen slowly and deliberately wrote down the words,
we are going to war.
There, it was done. Pulling off his spectacles, the Geg tossed them down upon the table, put his head in his hands, and wept. Chapter 56. Castle Sinister, High Realm. Sinistrad and Hugh were seated in the study of the Mysteriarch. It was nearly midday. Light streamed in through a crystal window. Seeming to float on the mist outside the window were the glittering spires of the city of New Hope, the city that, according to what Iridol had told him, might as well be called No Hope. Hugh wondered if the buildings had been placed there for his benefit. Outside, coiled around the castle, dozing in the sun, was the Quicksilver Dragon. Let us see. What would be best? Sinistrad tapped thoughtfully on the desk with his thin fingers. We will transport the child back to Jern Volcane on the elven ship, taking care, of course, to make certain that the ship is seen by the humans. Then, when Stephen and Anne are discovered dead, it will be blamed on elves. Bane can tell them some rigmarole about how he was captured and escaped, and the elves followed him and killed his loving parents as they tried to rescue him. You can make it appear that the elves murdered them, I suppose? The air around Hugh stirred. A cold breath swept over him, and icy fingers seemed to touch his shoulder. Iridol was working her own magic against her husband. She was here. She was listening.
Sure, nothing's easier. Will the boy cooperate? Asked Hugh, tensing, yet doing his best to seem at ease.
Now that she was faced with inescapable truth, what would she do?
The kid seems less than enthusiastic.
He will cooperate. I have only to make him understand that this is to his advantage. Once he knows how he can profit by this action, he will be eager to undertake it. The boy is ambitious, and rightfully so. After all, he is my son. Invisible to all eyes, Iridol stood behind Hugh, watching, listening. She felt nothing at hearing Sinistrad plot murder. Her mind, her senses had gone numb. Why did I bother to come, she asked herself. There's nothing I can do. It's too late for him, for me, but not too late for Bane. How did the ancient saying go? A little child shall lead them. How did the ancient saying go? A little child shall lead them. Yes, there is hope for him. He is still innocent, unspoiled. Perhaps someday he will save us.
Ah, here you are, Father.
Bane entered the study, coolly ignoring Sinistrad's glaring frown. The child's color was heightened, and he seemed to glow with an inner radiance. His eyes gleamed with a feverish luster. Walking behind the boy, its nails clicking against the stone floor, the dog appeared worried and unhappy. Its eyes went to Hugh, pleading. Its gaze shifted to a point behind the assassin, staring at Iridol so intently that she felt a panicked qualm and wondered if her spell of invisibility had ceased to work. Hugh shifted uneasily in his chair. Bane was up to something. Probably, from that beatific expression on his face, no good. "Bane, I'm busy. Leave us," said Sinistrad.
"No, Father. I know what you're talking about. It's about me going back to Volcarim, isn't it?"
"Don't make me, Father."
The child's voice was suddenly sweet and soft.
"Don't make me go back to that place. No one likes me there. It's lonely. I want to be with you. You can teach me magic like you taught me to fly. I'll show you all I know about the great machine, and I can introduce you to the High Froman."
"Stop whining." Sinistrad rose to his feet. His robes rustled around him as he moved out from behind his desk to confront his son. "You want to please me, don't you, Bane?"
"Yes, Father,"
the boy faltered.
"More than anything, that's why I want to be with you. Don't you want to be with me? Isn't that why you brought me home?"
"Bah, what nonsense. I brought you home so that we could put into action the second phase of our plan. Certain things have changed now, but only for the better. As for you, Bane, as long as I am your father, you will go where I tell you to go and do what I tell you to do. Now leave us. I will send for you later." Sinistrad turned his back on the child. Bane, a strange smile on his lips, thrust his hand into his tunic. It came out holding a knife.
"I guess you won't be my father long, then."
"How dare you?" Sinistrad whirled around, saw the dagger in the child's hand, and sucked in a seething breath. Pale with fury, the Mysteriarch raised his right hand, prepared to cast the spell that would dissolve the child's body where he stood. "I can get more sons." The dog leapt, hit Bane square in the back, and knocked the child to the floor. The dagger flew from the boy's hand. Something unseen struck Sinistrad. Invisible hands clutched at his. Raging, he grappled with his wife, whose spell crumbled as she fought, revealing her to her husband. Hugh was on his feet. Snatching up his dagger from the floor, he watched for his opportunity. He'd free her child. The wizard's body crackled with blue lightning. Iridol was flung aside in a thunderous shockwave that hurled her dazed against the wall. Sinistrad turned upon his child, only to find the dog standing above the terrified boy. Teeth bared, hackles raised, it growled low in its throat. Hugh struck, driving the dagger deep into the wizard's body. Sinistrad screamed in fury and in pain. The assassin jerked his dagger free. The body of the Mysteriarch shimmered and faded, and Hugh thought his foe was dead. Suddenly the wizard returned, only now his body was that of an enormous snake. The snake's head darted at Hugh. The assassin drove his knife again into the reptilian body, but too late. The snake sank its fangs into the back of Hugh's neck. The assassin cried out in agony, the poison surging through his body. He managed to retain his grip on the knife, and the snake, twisting and coiling, drove the blade deeper. It lashed out in its death throes, wrapped its tail around the assassin's legs, and both crashed to the floor. The snake disappeared. Sinistrad lay dead, his legs wrapped around the feet of his killer. Hugh stared at the corpse and tried feebly to rise. The assassin felt no pain, but he had no strength left in him, and he collapsed.
"Hugh."
Weakly he turned his head. It was pitch dark in the cell. He couldn't see.
"Hugh, you were right. Mine is the sin of not doing. And now it is too late, too late."
There was a crack in the wall. A thin shaft of light gleamed brightly. He could smell fresh air, perfumed with the scent of lavender. Slipping his hand through the bars of his cell, Hugh held it out to her. Reaching out as far as she could from behind her own walls, Iridol touched the tips of his fingers. And then the black monk came and set Hugh free. Chapter 57. Castle Sinister, High Realm. A low rumbling sound caused the stones of the palace to quiver on their foundation. It grew louder, like thunder heard in the distance, marching toward them, shaking the ground. The castle shifted, stone quaked and shuddered. A triumphant howl split the air.
What the?
Haplo stared around him. The dragon's free, murmured Alfred, eyes widening in awe.
Something's happened to Sinistrat. It'll kill every living thing in this castle. I've fought dragons before. They're numerous in the labyrinth. You?
No, never.
Alfred glanced at the patron, caught the bitter smile.
It will take both of us to fight it in the might of our power.
No, Haplo shrugged.
You were right. I don't dare reveal myself. I'm not permitted to fight, not even to save my life.
I guess it's up to you, Sartan.
The floor shook. A door down the corridor opened, and Limbeck looked out.
This is more like home, he shouted cheerfully over the rumbling and thudding and cracking.
Walking easily across the trembling floor, he waved a sheaf of papers.
Do you want to hear my speech?
The outer walls split asunder. Alfred and Limbeck were flung from their feet. Haplo slammed up against a door that gave way behind him with a crash. A gleaming red eye the size of the sun peered through the ruptured wall at the victims trapped inside. The rumbling changed to a roar. The head reared back, jaws opening. White teeth flashed. Haplo staggered to his feet. Limbeck was lying flat on his back, his spectacles smashed on the stone floor. Groping for them, the Geg stared up helplessly at the red-eyed silver blur that was the dragon. Near Limbeck lay Alfred, fainted. Another roar shook the building. A silver tongue flickered like lightning. If the dragon destroyed them, Haplo would lose not only his life, but also his purpose for coming here. No Limbeck to lead the revolution among the Gegs. No Limbeck to start the war that would lead to worldwide chaos. Haplo ripped the bandages from his hands. Standing over the fallen, he crossed his arms and raised Sigler-tattooed fists above his head. He wondered briefly where the dog had gone. He couldn't hear anything from it, but then he couldn't hear much of anything at all over the bellowings of the dragon. The creature dived for him, mouth open wide to snatch up the prey. Haplo was right. He'd fought dragons before, dragons in the labyrinth, whose magical powers made this quicksilver look like a mudworm. The hardest part was standing there, braced to take the blow, when every instinct in the body shrieked for him to run. At the last instant, the silver head veered aside, jaws snapping on empty air. The dragon pulled back, eyeing the man suspiciously. Dragons are intelligent beings. Coming out of enthrallment leaves them furious and confused. Their initial impulse is to strike back at the Magus who ensorcelled them. But even raging, they do not attack mindlessly. This one had experienced many types of magical forces in its lifetime, but never anything quite like what it faced now. It could feel, if it could not see, power surround the man like a strong metal shield. Steel the dragon could pierce. It might even pierce this magic if it had time to work on it and unravel it. But why bother? There were other victims. It could smell hot blood. Casting Haplo a last curious, baleful glance, the dragon slid out of his view. But it'll be back, especially if it gets a taste of fresh meat. Haplo lowered his hands. And what do? Take my little friend here and leave? My work in this realm is completed, or almost so. He could hear at last, and he heard what his dog was hearing. His brow furrowed, he absently rubbed the skin on his hands. From the sounds of it, the dragon was smashing in another part of the castle. Iridor and the boy were still alive, but they wouldn't be for long. Haplo looked down at the unconscious Sartan. I could send you into a faint that would last as long as I needed it to last, and transport you to my lord. But I've a better idea. You know where I've gone. You'll figure out how to get there. You'll come to me of your own accord. After all, we have the same goal. We both want to find out what happened to your people. So, old enemy, I'll let you cover my retreat. Kneeling beside Alfred, he grabbed hold of the Sartan and shook him roughly.
Come out of it, you craven scum!
Alfred blinked and groggily sat up.
I fainted, didn't I? I'm sorry, it's a reflex action. I can't control...
I don't want to hear about it, Haplo interrupted.
I've driven the dragon off for the time being, but it's only gone looking for a meal that won't fight back.
You saved my life?
Alfred stared at the patron.
Not your life, Limbeck's. You just happened to be in the way.
A child's thin wail of terror rose in the air. The dragon's howl cracked solid stone. Haplo pointed in the creature's direction. The boy and his mother are still alive. You'd better hurry. Alfred swallowed hard, sweat beading on his forehead. Shakily, he rose to his feet and, with a trembling hand, traced a sigil on his chest. His body began to fade.
Goodbye, Sartan, called Haplo, for the time being. Limbeck, are you all right? Can you walk?
My spectacles!
Limbeck picked up bent frames, poked his fingers through the empty rims.
Don't worry, said Haplo, helping the Geg to his feet.
You probably don't want to see where we're going anyway. The patron paused a moment to run through everything in his mind, foment chaos in the realm. His rune-covered hand closed fast over Limbeck's. I've done that, my lord. I'll transport him back to Drevlin. He will be the leader of the revolt among his people, the one who will plunge this world into war. Bring me someone from this realm who will be my disciple, someone who will spread the word, my word, to the people, someone who will lead the people like sheep to my fold. It shall be someone intelligent, ambitious, and pliable. Haplo, with his quiet smile, whistled for the dog. Irridol had tamed dragons before in her girlhood, but only gentle creatures that would have almost done her bidding without enchantment. The dragon she faced now had always terrified her, perhaps as much because Sinistrad had ridden it as the dragon itself. She longed to be able to crawl into the corner of that safe, secure cell in which she had been hiding, but the prison was gone. The walls were beaten down, the door had swung open, the bars fallen from the windows. A chill wind tore at her. The light was blinding to eyes long accustomed to shadow. The sin of not doing. Now it was too late for her, for the child. Death was their only freedom. The dragon's roarings thundered above her. Irridol watched impassively as the ceiling split wide open. Dust and rock cascaded down around her. A fiery red eye peered in at them. A lightning-like tongue flicked in desire. The woman did not move. Too late. Too late. Crouched behind his mother, his arm clasped tightly around the dog's neck, Bane stared round-eyed. After his first cry of fear, he'd fallen silent, watching, waiting. The dragon couldn't reach them yet. It couldn't get its huge head into the small hole it had created, and was forced to rip more blocks from the castle walls. Driven by rage and a hunger for the blood it could smell, it was working rapidly. The dog suddenly turned its head, looked back over its shoulder at the door, and whined. Bane followed the dog's gaze and saw Haplo standing in the doorway, beckoning to him. Beside Haplo was Limbeck, peering dimly through the dust and rubble, gazing benignly at a horror he could not see. The child looked up at his mother. Irridol was staring fixedly at the dragon. Bane tugged at her skirt.
Mother, we must leave. We can hide somewhere. They'll help us.
Irridol did not turn her head. Perhaps she had not heard him. The dog whimpered and, gripping hold of Bane's tunic in his teeth, attempted to tug the boy toward the door.
Mother! The boy cried.
Go along, child, said Irridol. Hide somewhere. That's a good idea.
Bane grasped hold of her hand.
But aren't you coming, Mother?
Mother, don't call me that. You're not my child.
Irridol gazed at him with a strange and dreamlike calm.
When you were born, someone switched the babies. Go along, child.
She spoke to someone else's son.
Run away and hide. I won't let the dragon harm you.
Bane stared at her.
Mother!
He cried out again, but she turned from him. The boy grasped for the amulet around his neck. It was gone. He remembered he had torn it off.
Bring him! Haplo shouted.
The dog got a grip on the boy's shirt and pulled. Bane saw the dragon thrust a taloned claw through the hole it had created in the ceiling and make a grab for its prey. Stone walls crashed down. Dust rose, obliterating his mother from his sight. The claw groped, feeling for the warm flesh it could smell. A red eye peered inside, searching for its prey. Irridol fell back, but there was nowhere to hide in the rubble-strewn, partially collapsed chamber. She was trapped in a small area beneath the hole in the ceiling. When the dust cleared and the creature could see, it would have her. She tried desperately to concentrate on her magic. Closing her eyes to blot out the fearsome sight, she formed mental reins and tossed them over the dragon's neck. The infuriated creature roared and tossed its head. Jerking the reins out of her mental grasp, the dragon's opposing magic came near overthrowing the woman's reason. A claw slashed at Irridol's arm, tearing her flesh. The ceiling gave way. Shards of stone fell all around her, striking her, knocking her down. The dragon, screeching in triumph, swooped on her. Gasping, choking in the dust, she crouched on the floor, her face averted from death. Irridol waited almost impatiently to feel the sharp, searing pain, the talons piercing her flesh. Instead, she felt a gentle hand on her arm.
Don't be afraid, child.
Incredulously, she raised her head. Bane's servant stood before her. Stoop-shouldered, his bald head covered with marble dust, the fringes of gray hair sticking out ludicrously, he smiled reassuringly at her, then turned to face the dragon. Slowly, solemnly, and gracefully, Alfred began to dance. His voice raised in a thin, high-pitched chant to accompany himself. His hands, his feet, traced unseen sigla. His voice gave them names and power. His mind enhanced them. His body fed them. Burning acid dripped from the dragon's flicking tongue. Momentarily startled, feeling the man's magic and uncertain what it was, the creature drew back to consider the matter. But it had already been thwarted once. The lure of flesh and the memory of what it had endured at the hands of the detested wizard drove it on. Snapping jaws dived down, and Irridul shivered in terror, certain the man must be bitten in two. "Run!" she screamed at him. Alfred, looking up, saw his danger, but he merely smiled and nodded almost absent-mindedly, his thoughts concentrating on his magic. His dance increased in tempo, the chanting grew a little louder. That was all. The dragon hesitated. The snapping jaws did not close, but remained poised over their victim. The creature's head swayed slightly in time to the rhythm of the man's voice. And suddenly the dragon's eyes widened and began to stare about in wonder. Alfred's dance grew slower and slower, the chanting died away, and soon he came to a weary halt and stood gasping for breath, watching the dragon closely. The quicksilver didn't seem to notice him. Its head thrust through the gaping hole in the castle wall, gazed at something only it could see. Turning to Irido, Alfred knelt beside her. "He won't harm you now. Are you hurt?"
"No."
Keeping a wary eye on the dragon, Irridul took hold of Alfred's hand and held it fast.
"What have you done to it?"
"The dragon thinks that it is back in its home, its ancient home, a world only it can remember. Right now it sees earth below and sky above, water in the center, and the sun's fire giving life to all."
"How long will the enchantment last? Forever?"
"Nothing lasts forever. A day, 2 days, a month perhaps. It will blink, and all will be gone, and it will see only the havoc that it wreaked. By that time, perhaps, its anger and pain will have subsided. Now, at least, it is at peace."
Irridul gazed in awe at the dragon, whose giant head was swaying back and forth as if it heard a soothing, lulling voice.
"You've imprisoned it in its mind," she said.
"Yes," Alfred agreed. "The strongest cage ever built."
"And I am free," she said in wonder. "And it isn't too late. There is hope. Bane, my son, Bane!"
Irridul ran toward the door where she'd last seen him. The door was gone. The walls of her prison had collapsed, but the rubble blocked her path.
"Mother, I am your son!
Bane tried to cry out again to her, but a sob welled up in his throat, shutting it off. He couldn't see her. The falling stone blocked his view. The dog, barking frantically, ran around him in circles, nipping at his heels, trying to herd him away. The dragon gave a dreadful shriek, and, terrified, Bane turned and ran. Halfway to the door, he nearly fell over Sinistrad's body.
"Father?"
Bane whispered, reaching out a trembling hand.
"Father, I'm sorry."
The dead eyes stared at him, unseeing, uncaring. Bane stumbled back and tripped, stumbling over Hugh, the assassin paid to kill him, who had died to give him life.
"I'm sorry," the child wept. "I'm sorry. Don't leave me alone. Please, don't leave me alone."
Strong hands, with blue sigla tattooed on the backs, caught hold of Bane and lifted him up out of the wreckage. Carrying him to the doorway, Haplo set the stunned and shaken boy on his feet next to the geg. "Both of you keep near me," the patron ordered. He lifted his hands, crossed his arms. Fiery runes began to burn in the air, one appearing after another. Each touched, yet never overlapped. They formed a circle of flame that completely encompassed the three of them, blinded them with its brilliance, yet did not harm them. "Here, dog," Haplo whistled. The dog, grinning, leapt lightly through the fire and came to stand at his side. "We're going home." Epilogue. "And so, Lord of the Nexus, that's the last I saw of the Sartan. I know you're disappointed, perhaps even angry, that I didn't bring him back. But I knew Alfred would never allow me to take the boy or the geg, and as he said himself, I could not risk fighting him. It seemed to me to be a splendid irony that he should be the one to cover my escape. Alfred will come to us of his own accord, my lord. He can't help himself now that he knows Death's Gate swings open." "Yes, my lord, you are correct. He has another incentive, his search for the child. Alfred knows I took the boy. I heard before I left Dreblin that the Sartan and the boy's mother, Irridul, had joined together to look for her son. As for the boy, I think you'll be pleased with Bane, my lord. There is potential in him. Naturally, he was shaken by what happened in the castle at the last, the death of his father, the horror of the dragon. It's made him thoughtful. So if you find him quiet and subdued, be patient with him. He is an intelligent boy, and will soon learn to honor you, Lord, as we all do. And now to finish my story. When I left the castle, I took the boy and the geg with me to the elven ship. Here we discovered that the elf captain and his crew were being held prisoners by the Mysteriarchs. I made a deal with Botherel. In return for his freedom, he would take us back to Dreblin. Once there, he would hand over his ship to me. Botherell had little choice but to agree. He either accepted my terms or met death at the hands of the wizards. The Mysteriarchs are powerful and desperate to escape their dying realm. I was, of course, forced to use my magic to free us. We could not have fought them successfully otherwise. But I was able to work my magic without the elves seeing me. They didn't notice the runes. In fact, they now believe that I'm one of the Mysteriarchs myself. I didn't disillusion them. The assassin was correct in his estimation of the elves, my lord. He will find that they are people of honor, as are the humans in their own curious way. As he had agreed, Botherell flew us to the Low Realm. The Geg, Limbeck, was greeted by his people as a hero. He is High Froman of Dreblin now. His first act was to launch an attack against an elven ship attempting to dock and take on water. In this, he was helped by Captain Botherell and his crew. A combined force of elves and dwarves attacked the ship, and singing that strange song I told you about, they managed to convert all the elves on it. Botherell told me before he left that he intended to take the ship to this Prince Rishan, leader of the rebellion. He hopes to form an alliance between the rebel elves and the dwarves against the Tribus Empire. It is rumored that King Stephen of the Uelandia Cluster will join them. Whatever the outcome, world war rages in Arianus, my lord. The way is prepared for your coming. When you choose to enter the realm of Sky, the war-weary people will look upon you as a savior. As for Limbeck, he, as I predicted, has become a powerful leader. Because of him, the dwarves have rediscovered their dignity, their courage, their fighting spirit. He's ruthless, determined, not afraid of anything. His dreamy-eyed idealism broke with those spectacles of his, and he sees more clearly now than ever before. He has, I'm afraid, lost a girlfriend, but then Jara spent time alone with the Sardin. Who can say what strange notions he put into her head? As you can imagine, my lord, it took me some time to prepare the elven ship for its journey into Deathgate. I transported it and Bane down to the steps of Terrell Fen, near where my own ship had crashed, so that I could work undisturbed. It was while I was performing the necessary modifications, using the Kixie Winsy to assist me, that I heard about the Sartan and the boy's mother and their search. They had traveled as far as Drevlin. Fortunately, I was ready to leave. I sent the boy into a deep slumber and made my way back through Deathgate. This time I knew the perils I faced and was prepared for them. The ship sustained only minor damage, and I can have it repaired and refitted in time for the next journey. That is, my lord, if I have earned the right to be sent on another such mission. Thank you, my lord. Your praise is my greatest reward. And now I propose a salute. This is Boer wine, a gift from Captain Botherell. I think you will find its taste extremely interesting, and it seemed to me fitting that we should drink to the success of our next mission in what we might call the blood of Arianus. To Deathgate, my lord, and our next destination, the Realm of Fire. Magic in the Sundered Realms, excerpt from Asartan's Musings. Magic is a thunder heard in each of the sundered realms. Its power reverberates through the foundations of all existence. It echoes the lightning of creation itself. In its voice is heard the promise of life and death. It is a power to be coveted and feared. Theorists tell us that magic draws its power from the original creation of the omniverse. In the beginning, Elihan, God in one, stretched out his hand amid the chaos. The motion of his hand ordered chaos into infinite possibilities of creation. This motion was the first order out of chaos. It is called the wave prime, or more often simply, the prime. Elihan saw in the prime the creation of the ethereal and the physical, and the seeing of it made it so. In the creation of the spiritual and the physical, the prime split into two sets of waves, each infinite in their possibilities. The two waves curved away from each other and back again. The waves crossed, and where they crossed was created time and space. Thus was reality woven from the forces of all possibilities. With delight and wonder, Elihan looked again upon both waves. In the ethereal, he saw the creation of air and fire. In the physical, he saw water and stone. And the seeing of it made it so. Again, in its creation, the waves of ethereal and physical possibilities each split into four new waves, each with infinite possibilities of new creation. Elihan again wove these new possibilities together. In the intersection of the waves was born life, death, power, and mind. The longer Elihan looked upon the weave of reality, the more possibilities split into being. Stars, world, life, in short, all creation, was thus woven from infinite possibilities. So it was in the beginning, and so it continues today. Reality is simply the manifestation of intersecting waves of possibility. It is a vast and almost incomprehensible weave of solid physics in the midst of a myriad of infinite potentials. Science, technology, and biology all use the woven rope of reality. Magic, on the other hand, functions by reweaving the fabric of reality. A wizard begins by concentrating on the wave of probabilities rather than on reality itself. Through his learning and his powers, he looks out upon the myriad waves of infinite possibilities to find that part of the wave where his desired reality would be true. Then the wizard creates a harmonic wave of possibility to bend the existing wave so that what was once only possible becomes part of what is true. In this way, the magician weaves his desire into existence. For example, a wizard stands on a field of battle against a great knight. The spellcaster, wearing only his robes, is at the mercy of the armored and more powerful knight. This is reality, and if left alone, the knight will most likely slay the wizard without much resistance. However, the wizard knows from his study where the possibility, desired effect, of a protective shield exists on one of the countless waves of possibility. The wizard sets up a harmonic wave of possibility through his motions, thoughts, words, signs, and other aids. This magic alters the possibility wave so that what was once the possibility of a magical shield is woven into reality. The new reality includes the desired effect, and so the magical shield now guards the wizard. Although to the outside observer the protective field seems to spring up around the wizard from nothing, it would be more accurate to say that the possibility of such a field has been called into reality from the infinite possibilities of the omni-wave. To use magic, one must be able to find and weave the appropriate portion of the omni-wave in some small degree. This is far from omnipotence or omniscience, even among those who see a vast section of the wave. Being able to function in the discipline of magic does not explain why magic exists or its origins. It does not lead one to the reason for being. Just as knowing a rock will fall when dropped does not tell us why gravity exists or what intelligence brought such order out of chaos, so it is, too, with magic. Only the Sartan and the Patrons understood magic to the fullest degree. Having seen magic from the center of the omni-wave, we mastered the art in the most elemental and powerful form. No others have seen as much of the omni-wave as we have. The fundamental relationships of magic are seen in this drawing. The closer to the center the magic is, the greater is power. Rune magic, the most elemental and centered of all magics, is thus the most powerful and commands the most far-reaching effects. Each great level of understanding is designated as a house. Each of these houses can be thought of in terms of how much of the omni-wave the user of that level of magic perceives. The more central the house, the more of the wave prime they can perceive and use. The greatest force of all is the magic of house rune, which combines the waves of life, power, mind, and death into a comprehension of the central weave of reality and a clear picture of the infinite possibilities of the omni-wave. Those who have mastered rune magic are said to have reached the ninth mastery, or the final mastery. The knowledge and potency of the rune disciplines are all tied directly to the rune siglas, which are used in the casting of such spells. With the sundering of time, however, only we, the Sartan, and the Patrons, if they still exist, have knowledge of rune magics. The unified magic of House Rune is then divided into the four lesser houses of Firmament, Air, Sun, Fire, Spring, Water, and Dark, Earth. Together they are known as the Sovereign Masteries. The Sovereign Masteries represents the Eighth Mastery, and are second only to Rune Magic in power. Each of the Sovereign Masteries is then further divided equally into Spiritual and Physical Masteries. The Spiritual Masteries tend toward mental and emotional manipulation of the world about the magician. The Physical Masteries tend to use and make use of physical objects in the world about the wizard. Both the Spiritual and Physical Masteries are further divided into the greater and lesser disciplines in each house. Greater disciplines are known as House Advocate, while the lesser disciplines are referred to as House Servitor. House Advocate includes 5th through 7th Masteries, while House Servitor is made up of 1st through 4th Masteries. The terms greater and lesser are somewhat deceptive in that the lesser disciplines are the broadest based and most commonly used of the magics. The greater disciplines, while more powerful, also tend to be more specialized. After the sundering of time, the Patrons vanished, and a certain jealousy guarded rune magic from mortal learning. This brought about the loss of any magic greater than 7th mastery in any of the realms as now constituted. Rune magic is now unknown among any of the mortal peoples of any realm. It remains a carefully guarded secret. Rune magic. Rune magic is the most powerful manifestation of all the magics present in the realms. Rune magic weaves all the elements of the various house sovereigns into a single magic whole. As such, rune magic touches on the fabric of all creation. It was this rune magic which was the instrument by which the unified creation was sundered into its current parts. The key to rune or runic magic is that the harmonic wave that weaves a possibility into existence must be created with as much simultaneity as possible. This means that the various motions, signs, words, thoughts, and elements that go into making up the harmonic wave must be completed as close together as possible. The more simultaneous the harmonic wave structure, the more balance and harmony will be maintained in the wave, and the more powerful the magic itself. This is rather like the difference between throwing a war ball end over end and spiraling it. Footnote, war ball is a game popularized in ancient times, and which is still played in a variety of forms in all of the realms. War balls are generally cylindrical and oblong in shape. They are also generally weighted and balanced for aerodynamic flight when thrown. End of footnote. A wheel which is rolled straight will roll farther than one which is sent wobbling. To attain this simultaneity, both the Sartan and the Patrons have developed magical languages and structures to convey their magic. Used only for magic, this language is unlike any other used in any of the realms. A second, more traditional language is used for standard communication by both of these races. The rune language is not so much spoken, although that is one element, as it is performed. The common element in both languages is their simultaneity. Traditional languages are sequential in their structure along single-channel linear lines. When one reads words on a page, he reads letter after letter, word after word, sentence after sentence to build up a complete thought or meaning of the text. This means he is taking in the message through only one channel or source of experience at a time. When people watch a play, however, they are taking in several channels at one time: the words spoken, the gestures and poise of the actor, the lighting of the scene. One might also get multiple messages over a single channel at one time, seeing the actor, the actor's chair, and the backdrop of the stage all at the same time. The play's messages are all hitting the audience simultaneously. For this reason, the play is said to have simultaneity in its communication of ideas. The complexity, balance, and harmony of magic requires perfection in simultaneous communication of the magician's harmonic waves. This is generally conveyed through performance of the magic by the magician through words, tones, gestures, and motion. In rune magic, the simultaneity is bound up in the concept of a non-linear written language. The rune languages have evolved into two separate types along the lines of the Sartan and the Patron cultures. Both operate the runic principles of the universe, but their structure and methods are somewhat different. Sartan rune magic. The Sartan use a hexagonal structure which is generally conveyed through six channels of communication at the same time. This involves the use of runes which are either drawn into or on an object, or created in the air through performance art. In performance, the casting wizard is limited to three channels, which include sound, auditory with complex harmonics, shape, gestures and dance positioning, mind, telepathic projections. The use of structured runes at the same time, sigla inscribed on objects such as staves, wands, rings, clothing, or any properly positioned object, can communicate the remaining three elements of the pattern. All Sartan rune structures are built in a hexagonal pattern emanating from the fountain or root rune. This rune is the source of the magic being cast, and the point from which all the magical structure springs. The fountain rune determines the thrust of the spell structure. In rune magic, this fountain rune may be of any type from any of the houses of magic. In complex spells, then, it is essential in the reading of the spell that one understands which rune is the fountain rune. Two separate spells, which have identical runes in identical positions, may have vastly different effects if they have different fountain runes. Root structures. Root structures bring the power of magic into the complex of the rune spell. These structures begin with root itself, a rune which designates the source of magic coming from either power, mind, life, or death. This root rune, or as it is more often called, the fountain rune, is flanked on its lower left side by its patriarch, the rune preceding it as seen in the illustration. It is flanked on its lower right side by its matriarch, the rune following the patriarch for that root. These support the root and give direction to the power of magic welling up from the runes below it. Directly below the root is the dom, or master. The top of the dom borders the bottom of the root and touches on both the patriarch and the matriarch. This rune determines whether the nature of the power called forth will be spiritual or physical in nature and completes the root structure. Nearly always, other runes connect to the Dom from below to further define and amplify the power of the magic being cast. The fountain rune is flanked on its upper left side by Dawn and on its upper right side by Dusk. These runes determine the amplitude, how much power, and vector direction to which the harmonic wave will be applied into the complex where the root structure is found. Between the Dawn and Dusk runes is the head, which completes the root structure. The head is part of a further complex of runes which transfers the elements of the root structure into the general harmonic of the magic being called into existence. The fountain rune, center of magic. The fountain rune is both the center of the magical concept which is created when the spell is cast, as well as the essential point of perspective from which rune magic is read and understood. It is crucial to the proper reading of runes that the fountain rune be known and located in the structure. Similar rune structures take on completely different meanings when different fountain runes are chosen. Here, by way of example, is a very simple rune structure. There is no indication of the fountain rune. Which rune does one pick? Where does one begin? Here are two possible interpretations of this rune structure. Reader's note, here are described two diagrams. Possible rune magic interpretation suggesting healing physical damage to the mind. Fountain rune center of magic. 2. Second possible rune magic interpretation suggesting subtle physical attack directed at specific memories. Fountain rune center of magic. End of reader's note. This is the great secret in rune magic. The location of the fountain rune is known only to those who learn its location from the rune's creator. Much of a wizard's training involves learning how to determine the fountain rune as well as simple, rote memory of the locations of such runes. Without a sartan to teach the location of these fountain runes, the chances of understanding our magical writings is negligible. Patron rune magic. Little is known about patron magic except that which may help identify them. By their magic runes, we will know them should any ever be seen entering the sundered realms from their place beyond. Little more is known save by the patrons themselves. Like Sartan magic, patron rune magic also seeks the perfect balance in the harmonic wave. However, it does not find its balance through symmetry of structure. Patron rune magic looks for balance in weighted opposites. The patrons use a series of interlaced octagons and squares to form the pattern of their magic. Octagons form the source, course, and destiny of patron magic. Squares form the branch, juncture, and cascade of the magic. Combinations of these elements create the magic along 8 simultaneous channels of thought. As with Sartan magic, the fountain rune is critical to the success of understanding and using the magic. Patron magic uses substructures, rather like runes within runes. Runes formed of other runes then imitate the concepts of root, stem, or other structures found in Sartan magic in a much more concise way. However, their nature is somewhat erratic, and their use, unless carefully balanced, can lead to great lessening of the desired effect. Magic by realm. House rune works the same way in all the realms. Each realm, however, specializes in a particular magic of the sovereign masteries. This is usually indicative of the general division of magic which took place at the sundering of the realms. The magic of House Firmament, for example, would be the primary magic ruling in the sky realms, while House Life would rule primarily in the sea realms. Only the magic of House Life, that of Arianus, will be discussed here. End of side 10. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over. Lady of the Firmament, Disciplines of the Physical Mastery. The Lady of House Firmament, Physical Masteries, Transportation, and Motion Masters, are currently controlled by the Kankari Elves of the Tribus Empire. These white-haired, slender creatures have formed the Tribus Empire on the Aristogon continent. In conquest, they have subjugated all of their own continent and are waging wars of conquest on several others. Their powerful magic is physical in nature, requiring the use of objects to channel, contain, and direct their powers of magic. Despite their house, they have no powers of telepathy, but do manifest telekinetic powers through their magics. One power the Kankari elves have is the ability to weave complex messages into songs. This is an echo of the lost rune languages and a practical application of the more generally known magical languages, which create rougher, unbalanced spells in the magics of the sovereign masteries and below. The danger in these is that anyone can sing the song, Humans may be mildly inspired by these songs, but to the elves, such music communicates broad and deep elven feelings and messages. To gain full communication, the message of the song draws on genetic memories common among the elves, memories which the humans do not possess. These disciplines utilize two channels to communicate the structure of the magic, verbal tone, speaking the magic into auditory harmonics, and somatics, physical gestures of form to blend with the harmonics. If an elven wizard cannot speak or move freely, his magic will be crippled. Lord of the Firmament, Disciplines of the Spiritual Mastery. The Vondakar humans know their magic as Vond, the light, and more formally, Vondrith, the given power. Those who are adept in its use are known as the Kyr Vondrith, the light seers, and when spoken to are addressed simply either as Volker, light people, or as Kyr, seer. Some are certainly more adept than others at Vond, and its blessing seems to happen without pattern among the people. The magic of the Vondrith is primarily spiritual in nature and derives its abilities from the manipulation of nature and natural spirit. The Vondrith can affect natural animals and call weather to their aid. They can communicate with and manipulate animals. In this way, they handle the dragons. Though they have the capability to construct magic which would allow telepathy, the complexities of such magic with a more advanced mind have long since slipped from their understanding. The Volker have no formal schools. All teaching is done by master to apprentice. The Volker have been aggressive in their magic since the threat of domination by the Kenkare elves. Volker are used in battle to call natural infestations, plagues, sky rats, tornadoes, lightning, and the like. The Volker live for today and thrive on life and its pleasures. The Kyr are far from their brother Volker. This very disciplined order deals primarily with death. They see life as a punishment through which they must pass in order to gain their final reward in the Hvani, heaven, which is to come. They have developed magics of telepathy, but consider feeling empathetic joy and happiness a sin. They also have developed natural magics of transportation in order to assist them in their work of gathering the dead, as well as protections against poisons and disease. This magic uses two channels to communicate its structure, somatic gestures and mental projections of the concept. Speech is not needed to cast a spell in this mastery. It has earned the name of Silent Death from the elves who have learned the hard way just how effective a magic which does not require shouting can be in combat. A bound Kyr is crippled in his magic, but can still make limited mental constructs which will function well to aid his escape. Reader's note. The print edition includes here the lyrics and music to Hand is Flame, lyrics by Kevin Stein, music by Janet Pack. End of reader's note. End of Dragonwing, The Death Gate Cycle, Volume 1 by Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman.